You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
To this day, any mention of the Duke lacrosse team is likely to revive memories of one of the biggest scandals and media circuses of the 2000s. The story revolved around the explosive allegation that three wealthy white lacrosse players had brutally raped a black woman whom they'd hired as a stripper. In the end, the case collapsed and the players were exonerated, but the reverberations of the episode are still being felt to this day. Investigative journalist and Vanity Fair contributing editor William D. Cohn has called his exhaustive new account of the whole saga The Price of Silence, the Duke lacrosse scandal, the power of the elite, and the corruption of our great universities. It is published by Scribner, and I'm very pleased to welcome Mr. Cohn back to our show. Hello.
Great to be here, Leonard, always.
From what I remember, nearly everyone involved in the case was doing their darnest to get their own narrative into the media. So what or who was silent during this whole episode?
Well, that, of course, it was a title that is both at once sort of elegiac and also ironic in that, as you say, there was hardly anybody silent during this whole episode.
Everybody had an opinion.
Everybody had an opinion and expressed it regularly, usually on a sort of 24/7 basis. It was the combo of sort of Flight 370, Bridgegate of the time. But when I went back to write this book, you know, when I started, whatever, six or seven years later, what I found is that a lot of the people didn't want to talk about it.
Did they feel that the whole situation was settled?
Oh, there were definitely people who, especially, you know, to the victors goes the spoils. So the three indicted players who were exonerated, as you said, each got $20 million from Duke. And so, of course, they didn't want to talk about it.
Yeah, well, why would they want to talk about it?
Well, it's interesting. This is meant to be sort of a definitive book of the incident and what really happened and what didn't happen. If I had been exonerated and was flush with $20 million and somebody reputable was writing a book about it, I'd be more than happy to talk to them.
You went to Duke?
Yes, I did.
So did this have special resonance for you? Did it bring back memories of your time there, or have things changed a lot over the years?
All of the above. I felt that, like everybody, I was whipsawed by this story by the media coverage of it when it first came out. And so at first there's this rush to judgment to condemn the players, and then of course the narrative changes completely in a rush to judgment to blame the woman and the district attorney. And so I wanted to know, as a Duke alum who was trained there as a history major and an investigative reporter, what really happened?
So let's go back to the party that was hosted by the Duke lacrosse players in March 2006. Was it a fairly typical gathering for the players?
Well, apparently, yes, it was a rather typical gathering, sort of an all-day drinking event. It was during spring break. Most of everybody else was away from campus. The lacrosse team was on campus because they had a couple of games and practices. So apparently it had been like a 15-year tradition to have a big party during spring break, and it was an all-day thing. And then sometimes the lacrosse team would go to strip clubs, but this time they decided, let's just have the strippers come here.
And what did the strippers, Kim Roberts and Crystal Gale Magnum, think they'd been hired to do?
They were told that that they were going to a bachelor party. And when they got there, they realized it was not a bachelor party, that everyone was way too young and there were way too many people. And then they were told that they were just members of the track team and the baseball team. And then eventually it came out that they were members of the lacrosse team.
Now, lacrosse is not the same kind of sport. It's baseball or track or football, basketball at Duke especially. That's the big sport there. Lacrosse always struck me as a kind of an elitist sport. But these guys are not acting very elite, are they?
No, they're acting like 19 and 20-year-olds. They're acting like kids, who've been given a let out of jail free card, or and having a good time. Of course, yes, lacrosse traditionally, while it's one of the fastest growing sports in America, has traditionally been played in elite high schools, private high schools on the East Coast.
And it's a major feeder to the financial industry, isn't it?
Yes. Another irony is, of course, that whereas the basketball players and the baseball players and the football players have big, wealthy pro leagues to go to, and if they're good enough, they can pursue their ambitions. And in fact, Duke basketball sends more players to the NBA than any other college. Lacrosse doesn't have that. They have the NCAA tournament, and one of the great disappointments here for the players on the team was that their season was canceled in 2006, and they couldn't play in that NCAA tournament, even though they were favored to win.
We're a family show, so we can't get too graphic here, but what actually happened the night of the alleged assault, and what did Magnum claim happened?
So as one of my least favorite people, Donald Rumsfeld, would say, it's sort of a known unknown, i.e. we'll never know because there was no trial here. And the investigation that the state attorney general did was not made public. We'll never know what really happened in that bathroom, but Crystal Mangum alleged that she was raped, sexually assaulted, and kidnapped.
And was there any reason for her to do that, to make that claim?
Well, depends who you ask. If you ask her, she believed this happens, and when I interviewed her in prison, she... for where she was awaiting a trial for another matter, which we can get to later, she still believes something happened.
Well, there are also allegations that the players hurled racial epithets at the dancers. Is that in dispute?
No, that is not in dispute. And talk of, how shall we say, using a broomstick is also not in dispute. No, so there are many aspects of this that aren't in dispute. Underage drinking is not in dispute. Hiring the strippers, racial epithets, not in dispute.
Well, there was another stripper there.
Yes, Kim Roberts.
Wouldn't she be a witness to what actually happened?
Well, because what Crystal said is that she was taken into the bathroom by herself and separated from Kim Roberts, and that's where the alleged crime, supposedly took place.
So at what point and why did this story turn from an accusation of sexual assault at Duke University into a major national media story?
Well, I think obviously sexual assaults unfortunately happen on campuses all across the country, you know, all the time. I mean, that's why President Obama pulled together a task force of his cabinet in January to try to address this problem, which is basically out of control.
And we've been hearing a lot about some major universities actually sweeping these kinds of things under the rug, especially if athletes are involved.
Oh, yes. It's one of the favorite things to sweep under the rug. Why it became such a conflagration? I mean, part of it is the Schadenfreude related to Duke University because there are very few universities in the country that try to do what Duke does, which is to try to excel in academics and athletics. Stanford's another one, and frankly, some would argue that Duke, at least in the athletic realm, has succeeded far beyond even Stanford.
Well, are athletics rather than academics now the main driver at Duke?
No, I would not say so, but it's a very...
But they almost have what seems to be a professional basketball team.
Yes, a lot of colleges and universities have a professional basketball team, and this is playing out in real time with the NCAA and the efforts to unionize the Northwestern football team. I mean, of course, billions of dollars are at stake in this NCAA basketball tournament every year, none of which goes to the players, of course, and much of which goes to the universities and the NCAA. So this is very big business.
Well, how would you describe the culture at Duke? It doesn't have a great – I mean, it has this great academic reputation, but is it also known as a hard partying school?
So when I was there, we used to have a phrase called, at Duke that described Duke as sort of work hard, play hard ethos. And much to my surprise, actually, as I was researching the book, Duke knew about this description of the university and engaged one of the chaplains at the time to do two big studies of this sort of work hard, play hard ethos and to try to do something about it, but nothing's been done about it.
Well, on the other hand, if a school has a reputation for being fun to go to, that makes it more attractive. And Duke is one of the hardest universities in America to get into.
Yeah, it's a real differentiating factor, I have to say. I mean, there's a lot of talk about the Duke brand in general, and I talk about the importance of the Duke brand in this incident and the threat to it and why they had to end up paying, this party cost them $100 million. So preserving that Duke brand is a real differentiator in the market.
My guest is William D. Cohen. His latest book, The Price of Silence, The Duke Lacrosse Scandal, The Power of the Elite, and the Corruption of Our Great Universities. What was Crystal Magnum's history?
Oh, just the worst possible backstory of, I mean, as you can possibly imagine. On the one hand, she was a single mother of two young children. She had a third child during the pendency of the case. She was trying to put herself through North Carolina Central University, which is the predominantly black college in Durham, about 3 miles from Duke. They couldn't be, I mean, and worlds apart. But, you know, she was from Durham. She was sexually abused as a child. She, I mean, just her backstory is so heartbreaking. And she made these efforts to better herself by getting this education, by dancing, yes, to put herself to pay for her tuition. And the whole thing is extremely heartbreaking.
And she'd also had mental illness problems in the past.
Yes, there were many claims and documentary evidence of her having a mental illness and bipolar issues, yes.
Well, they do. They usually do a physical of somebody who claims to have been raped.
Yes, and they did in this case. And the woman who did the nurse who did the physical examination agreed with Crystal that there was evidence that she had been sexually assaulted.
What about many of the players who attended the party? What were their, what did they say? Were they even aware of what had gone on?
Well, again, a bunch of them said that they weren't aware of it. Others said that you know, it's what she's alleging is not true. There was no one who came forward and said what she's alleging was true.
Most of these kids came from wealthy families, didn't they? Is it fair to say that they came from privileged backgrounds?
I think some of them, yes. You know, it's hard to make a blanket statement. Interestingly, there were 47 players on the team, 46 who are white. There was one black player. Same with the women's lacrosse team, one black woman player on the team. It's an unusual ratio in sports today.
Well, since Duke is a two-pronged university, it has strong athletic program and also has strong academic program. Are those two at war with each other? And how do they fit into a town like Durham?
I don't think they're at war with each other. I mean, I really think it's part of the differentiation that is Duke. I mean, it's very exciting to be able to go to Duke for a great education, and you know, great to be able to go to Cameron Indoor Stadium and watch the Duke basketball team play and see, you know, nationally successful teams play in many different sports. Of course, Durham, by contrast, is, you know, 45% black. And so historically, the relationship between Duke and Durham has been quite strained. I think maybe in some ways this incident brought the two together. And Durham, by the way, now, I was just there the other day, is quite a thriving cosmopolitan place. And it used to be, you know, the center of black culture and black financial success in America. So it's got a very rich and important history. And it'd be great if Duke and Durham could, you know, sort of get it together, so to speak.
The week that the attack was alleged to have taken place, the lacrosse team was handed about $10,000 in cash by the coach?
So the players, many of whom were on scholarship, there was no dining halls open that week because it was spring break. So the coach gave them all meal money, which totaled about $10,000, according to one of the players. And it turned out, of course, since
where were they eating it, per se?
Well, it was about $30 a day kind of thing, 47 players. I don't think they were eating it per se, but since money is fungible, one could argue, and one of the players did, that was the money that was used to pay the dancers.
My guest is William D. Cohen, who is a Duke alumnus, best-selling author of Money and Power, House of Cards, and The Last Tycoons, also a contributing editor at Vanity Fair and a columnist for Bloomberg View. He has written a book called The Price of Silence, The Duke Lacrosse Scandal, The Power of the Elite, and the Corruption of Our Great Universities. It is published by Scribner. We will continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. We're back with William D. Cohen. His latest book, The Price of Silence, The Duke Lacrosse Scandal, The Power of the Elite and the Corruption of Our Great Universities. It is published by Scribner. Early in the book, you write about how Mike Krzyzewski, Duke's famed basketball coach, was considering jumping to the NBA, and how this generated a swell of campus support for the man who was already paid a huge amount of money. Was he the most powerful person on campus at that point?
Was and is and remains so. I mean, one of the former presidents of Duke, a guy named Keith Brody, who I quote in the book, says, you know, nobody could get in the New York Times like Mike Krzyzewski.
And yet he kept his mouth totally, he was totally silent about this scandal.
Yes, I would say mostly silent. He had one press conference along the way in the summer that really nobody paid much attention to.
Was he afraid, do you think, that this might wind up also spreading to talk about the other teams?
I think there was a tension at the university. I think the administration wanted Mike Krzyzewski to speak up and be more of a spokesman for what the administration was doing, but the trustees wanted him to be quiet, stay in his lane, not infect the basketball program.
I asked you earlier about tension between the academics and the athletes. Weren't some of the more serious Duke professors upset by the way athletes were treated? They were given a lot of slack. Sometimes be disruptive in class.
To put it mildly, this created a firestorm on campus between the professors, the administration, and the athletics department and the athletes. Lots and lots of tension, but it began, you know, one history professor, a fellow named Peter Wood, who actually I knew when I was at Duke, had written a very prescient letter 2 years earlier in 2004, where he basically said that the lacrosse players were disrupting his classes, and the whole situation was out of control. Like, they would not come to class, they would go to practice instead of coming to class.
Well, I would have thought that might be true of some other sports, but lacrosse?
Well, you know, it's the lacrosse team at Duke has, by the way, since this incident, has won two national championships. I mean, it's a perennial NCAA champion. These guys are quite the alpha males on campus.
And most schools really don't care much about lacrosse, but Duke obviously does.
There are a bunch of schools in the Northeast.
Yeah, Ivy League schools, mostly.
But ACC schools that really are into it, and the University of Denver in Denver is also former Princeton coach is now there, and he's got a sort of pick of everybody west of the Mississippi.
Now, the DA at in Durham, Mike, is it Nifong?
Nifong.
He eventually indicted three players in the case, but hadn't there been some issues with the identifications of the players by Magnum?
So, yes, there were every permutation you can possibly imagine happened in this case. She couldn't at first remember how many people had attacked her. She couldn't remember their names. Of course, they may have given her fake names. She eventually did identify, with the help of the police and an identification process, she did identify three of the players, two with 100% certainty, one with 90% certainty, and those were the three who were indicted.
What was Nifong's reputation as a prosecutor?
He had been in the Durham District Attorney's Office for 28 years prior to this and had a very good reputation. Didn't win all his cases, but hard-nosed, detail-oriented, shared information with defense attorneys.
But he was running for re-election as DA, and do you think that that played any role in his decision to charge ahead with this case because it was getting so much media coverage?
I personally don't think so. There are those who certainly do. He had announced he was running for election in his own right. He had been appointed DA when the previous DA became a judge. In December of 2005, he announced he was going to run for his own election in his own right, with the primary being May and then the final election being November. This, of course, happened in March. So, you know, he says you can't choose when things happen, and he thought this was a very important case that he needed to prosecute himself.
And he was reelected.
Yes, he was, and he won the primary in May, which signaled to everybody that the case was going to go forward, and then eventually he won the election in November.
And then the case collapsed. How did it collapse?
Well, so after he won the primary in May, and it looked like he was going to be elected, which is basically often a slam dunk in Durham County, The defense attorneys decided that they did not want this case to be brought to trial, and they wrote a bunch of letters to the state bar, which had previously been toothless with regard to prosecutorial misconduct. And they basically got the state bar to file charges against Mike Nifong that became known to him in December of 2006, and he had to defend those charges, and so he had to recuse himself from the case.
Did he feel that he was being railroaded?
Absolutely, he felt he was being railroaded, and I'm the only person he's had an interview with since all of this. We spent many hours together, and he told me that, of course, he felt he was railroaded.
And what's he doing now?
He's, quote-unquote, retired. He is the only person in this case who spent a time in jail. He spent a day in jail for contempt of court. He was fired. He was disbarred. He filed for personal bankruptcy because of the lawsuits against him. So he's living a quiet life now.
You spoke to him?
Yes.
Does he feel that he was right?
Yes, he believes something did happen in that bathroom. He thinks that justice was not done here. He thinks that the justice system was subverted. Because it's not supposed to work that, you know, if the prosecutor believes something happens and he's got witnesses who are ready to testify, he's supposed to be able to bring that case to trial. It's not right that the case is not brought to trial because of the clever legal strategies of defense attorneys in their deep pockets.
Well, the case was eventually handed over to North Carolina's Attorney General, Roy Cooper. That's kicking it upstairs, isn't it?
Yes, most definitely, and is somebody that could more easily potentially be controlled by the powers that be in the state. Mike Nifong was somebody that the defense and Duke clearly could not control. But after the state bar brought these charges against him and Mike Nifong decided he had to recuse himself from the case, he asked Crystal Mangum if she wanted to go forward with it at that time. This was in January of 07. That would have been a perfect moment for her to say, no, I've had enough of this, and nobody would blame her, frankly. But she said she still believed something happened. She wanted to testify. She knew it would be tough. She felt a crime had been committed, and she wanted to go forward. That's when Mike Nifong turned it over to Roy Cooper.
And after his investigation, Roy Cooper went as far as to declare that the three players were innocent. Was that an unusual step?
It's a shocking step because the word innocent isn't usually part of the jurisprudence lexicon.
Yeah, we say not guilty.
Yes, we do, after a trial. So here there was no trial. There was a secret four-month investigation by Roy Cooper, and he declared them innocent, declared Mike Nifong a rogue prosecutor, and decided not to bring false charge allegations against Crystal Mangum.
On the other hand, if they had been falsely accused, couldn't we say that they were innocent?
Again, it's not a word that's used in jurisprudent lexicon. I mean, Cy Vance or somebody like that would have thoughts on that, I'm sure.
Has Cooper's report ever been released?
He released a 20-page summary of it, which was public. His investigative files have never been released. I asked for them. They told me first that they had been destroyed by a court order. I asked them for the court order. I didn't remember that. They said, oh, no, we were actually wrong about that, but you still can't have them. So now I've filed a lawsuit in North Carolina federal court asking for that to be turned over to me.
It's not covered by the FOIA Act?
Well, no, it's not. There's a difference between federal FOIA and state FOIA. He's claiming that because it was a criminal investigation, he doesn't have to turn it over to me. But, of course, he declared them innocent, so there was no crime. So it's not technically a criminal investigation. He should turn them over.
My guest is William D. Cohen. His latest book, The Price of Silence, The Duke Lacrosse Scandal, The Power of the Elite, and the Corruption of Our Great Universities, is published by Scribner. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Well, I'm sure you have developed your own ideas about what happened. What do you think?
I get asked that a lot. No surprise. If I can just stipulate that I don't know and that we will never know unless, of course, Roy Cooper turns over some of this investigative material. Crystal Mangum, who I interviewed, believes something happened. Mike Nifong still believes something happened. There are some strange facts that the defense doesn't like to talk about, which leads me to believe that people have some splaining to do, as they say.
Well, when this thing was happening and generating so much media attention, how did students say that they felt about the lacrosse players and the accusations?
Well, again, students sort of don't really know what happened. I mean, a lot of Duke alumni were not said to themselves when this happened, oh, I can believe something like this may have happened. I think the students there at the time, many, you know, there were lots of protests on campus. I think the initial reaction was that this happened and this was outrageous and this has to be stopped. And of course, as the narrative completely got turned around during the course of 2006, you know, a lot of students then came to the defense of the lacrosse players.
And there were protests.
Lots of protests on campus, you know, especially during the first couple of months. You know, the campus was in an uproar.
Didn't some of the undergraduate faculty publish an open letter about the incident? What did they say?
Yes, this is called the infamous Group of 88. Basically, they said it's a long letter that was published, but the gist of it was, you know, this kind of predatory behavior, you know, whether it's true or not, can't continue on campus.
And what about the university administration? Did it stand by the students and try to? Or did they just try to distance themselves from the incident?
Again, walking a very, very fine line, and I don't blame them. And it was a very difficult position for them to be in, because by the time they even found out about it, the case was already in the criminal justice system. So they, you know, had to be very careful.
Especially President Richard H. Broadhead, who
was a former dean of Yale College, an English American literature scholar, an incredibly erudite man, but completely ill-prepared, as any college president would be, for both the fact that Coach Mike Krzyzewski might be leaving to go to the Lakers for a $40 million contract, as well as dealing with this crazy incident with the Duke lacrosse team.
As I understand it, although it's often charged that that rape accusations are false, it's quite rare that they are.
Well, I don't know.
8% or so is the estimate I've read.
That they're false. Mm-hmm. You know, the thing about a rape incident is that there's actually a victim who can testify. I mean, in other words, contrast that with, say, a murder case where there's no victim to testify. So I think what Mike Nifong, in this case, he believed Crystal Mangum. The police believed Crystal Mangum. The nurse who examined her that night believed her. So he was basing his case on that belief.
And that sounds like a reasonable justification for his position, and yet he's been disbarred.
Oh, my God, and completely disparaged. There are still lawyers working for these three indicted players who won't be happy until Mike Nifong is silenced. They were unhappy that he was able to speak to me for this book, and they want to silence him and, you know, bury him if they can, literally, I would think.
Well, the three indicted players, Finnerty, Seligman, and Evans, also didn't speak with you for this book. Why do you think they were reluctant to do that?
I think they signed, as part of their $20 million settlement agreements with Duke, they signed non-disparagement, non-disclosure agreements. But in the book, I do relay email correspondence I had with Mr. Seligman, who did want to talk to me, but to show me what a great guy he was, and I'm sure he may be. But you know, he and his lawyers were putting such tough strictures on me speaking to him that didn't make sense.
Well, they've all graduated and they've gone on to careers, successful careers.
One of them, David Evans, graduated from Duke. He got indicted the day after his graduation. He's now in private equity here in New York. Colin,
private equity, so he's gone legit. He's legal now.
Oh, yeah. He's having a great time. Colin Finnerty is now a broker at Deutsche Bank here in New York. He graduated from University of Maryland at Loyola, or Loyola at Maryland or something. And Reed Seligman graduated from Brown. He went to law school at Emory, and now he's clerking for a federal judge in Camden, New Jersey.
One of the players, Ryan McFadden,
yes,
sent an email out on the night of the incident. What did it say?
I don't think we can say what it said on this family radio station, but it was basically derivative, he said, of a Bret Easton Ellis novel, American Psycho, and he talked about sort of recreating the party that had occurred that night, the next night, but this time he was going to kill the strippers instead of whatever supposedly happened that night.
I'm assuming that email is still attached to him.
Yes, it was an incredible email. He thought he was just writing it to his friends on the lacrosse team. It was on the Duke servers. It's a real cautionary tale about what can happen. Eventually, it got turned over to the Durham police. People aren't really sure why. They took it very seriously. They obtained a search warrant from a judge, searched his room. They sealed that search warrant. When on April 5th, 2006, it was unsealed, of course, all hell broke loose. The coach was fired, the team season was suspended, and as was Ryan McFadden, suspended from the university.
You mentioned a lot of money was eventually paid out to the lacrosse players. But since it isn't totally clear that they had been falsely accused, why were people willing to – why was Duke and did was it also the DA's office willing to spend so much money?
No, it's only Duke. Duke has paid about $100 million in settlements. And
no wonder tuitions are so high.
They've got a lot of money. Their endowment is close to $9 billion. You know, I think that the logic for making these payments to the three players, $20 million each, was that to make it, A, go away, B, to, quote-unquote, protect the Duke brand, and three, there had been missteps that gave Duke felt it had legal exposure because of missteps made by administrators early on.
Well, there it sounds to me like the players' legal teams had been rather effective.
Unbelievable.
The parents paid for that, their defense?
Yes, there was a defense fund as well. It totaled into the millions of dollars, $3 to $4 million. If I get in trouble in North Carolina, I'm definitely hiring these defense attorneys.
Your subtitle is The Duke Lacrosse Scandal, The Power of the Elite. We've kind of covered that. And The Corruption of Our Great Universities. What do you mean by that?
Well, I mean, let's face it, the role of these athletes in Division I universities, and we see it virtually every day. We see it with Jameis Winston case at Florida State University. There's a conflagration on the internet about American University now. We see it at Duke. We've seen it at Penn State. We've seen it repeatedly that, unfortunately, they're given privilege status. They're given elite status. And a lot of their behavior, one looks the other way, not only in terms of what happens on campuses, I document in the book with them, all sorts of bad behavior that the administrators didn't check them on, at least on the lacrosse team, but you see in the justice system. I mean, this is not the way the justice system is supposed to work, that, you know, either with Jameis Winston, where the police do not follow through on their investigation, or with here in this case where there's no trial.
Well, you mentioned that the lacrosse team had only one black player. On the other hand, the basketball team probably has only one white player. I haven't counted, but
this past year they only had a few. That's right.
And race obviously is a major factor in this whole discussion. We're talking about a college that's situated in perhaps one of the more liberal places in the South, but still the South. So how important is race in this whole story?
Oh, race was part and parcel of this. I mean, this frankly had it all. It had race. It had privilege. It had class.
Mangum was also rather poor.
Poor. She was dancing to put herself through NCCU. She had a single mother. She was from Durham, which I said is 45% black. It's a very enlightened part of the state as far as North Carolina is concerned, especially these days. But, I mean, there were racial epithets thrown, as we discussed. No one questions that. It was a very, very ugly incident. And, of course, the fact that it was three white players and the dancers were black, I mean, added an obvious racial overtone. I mean, Jesse Jackson was involved. Al Sharpton was involved. NAACP was involved. I mean, could you imagine, though, if it would have been the reverse, if it had been two white dancers and three black players? I mean, the thought that there'd be no trial is inconceivable.
And the irony here that the DA is the only person who spent any time in jail?
Yes, it's unbelievable, frankly. I mean, he, for what he thought was just doing his job. I mean, there are people who think he's the Antichrist to this day and, again, won't be happy till he's not on Earth anymore. But if he made mistakes, and he'd be the first to admit them. But for him to be the only person to spend a day in jail and have his life be essentially terminated as he knew it after having a very long and distinguished career is extraordinary.
The book has gotten great reviews. On the other hand, there is a group that has attacked you on Amazon. Is it because of this?
It's because that I had the audacity to do a fair and balanced treatment of this incident as opposed to a polemic, which is the preferred way that this incident has been treated in the past.
Either they would prefer it for you to go in either direction?
Either direction. Obviously, with the preferred direction being the ones that the established narrative that the boys were innocent and everybody else was evil and in a conspiracy. I think just the fact that the book exists at all has gotten this very determined group of writers on Amazon. I mean, even I think I'm like have eight 4 or 5 star reviews and something like 45 1 star reviews at the moment.
You said that you spoke to Crystal Mangum in prison, but she wasn't sent to jail for this case.
No.
She stabbed her boyfriend?
Yes. Years later, she did stab her boyfriend. She said it was self-defense. He went to the Duke University Hospital for treatment. She claimed that there was medical malpractice that resulted in his death. That question went to a jury in Raleigh last November, and they found her guilty.
Well, her role in this story couldn't have helped her with that jury.
I wouldn't have thought so. I would have to say that a jury in Wake County, North Carolina, would be well aware of who Crystal Mangum was.
Hasn't the house that the lacrosse players were living in on North Buchanan Street been torn down?
Yes, in the sort of like dead of night kind of thing.
As a way of erasing the whole incident?
Yes, of course. It's now an empty lot, and there's houses all around it, but not there.
William D. Cohn, his latest book, The Price of Silence, The Duke Lacrosse Scandal, The Power of the Elite, and the Corruption of Our Great Universities, published by Scribner. Thank you so much for being on our show again.
Thank you, Leonard. Always a pleasure.